is Americana.
More than 1,800 years ago, a great historian wrote that rare is the felicity of the times when you can think what you like and say what you think. That felicity has indeed been rare throughout human history. The men who made our government thought they could guarantee it by almost immediately writing into the Constitution as its very first amendment the guarantee of freedom of religion, of speech, of the press. All corollaries of the basic right to think what you like. That seemed to have settled that. With a great price, our ancestors obtained their freedom, but we were born free.
The words you've just heard are from Elmer Davis's book, But We Were Born Free. This program is Americana, in part transcribed the 17th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you Notable Books.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. In my profession, which includes a little teaching, a little writing, and some study of communications, I hear a great many estimates of what the public is like. Sometimes I regret to say these estimates are rather unflattering, and I usually resent them because, as far as I know, I'm part of the public. You know the sort of notion I'm talking about. People won't read good books, won't listen to good music. The public has a mental age of 14 years. The public demands trash, and what can you do but give it to them, and so on. Now, in my calmer moods, I'm quite willing to believe anything about the public, for I've never met that curious composite mass entity in the flesh. I feel about the public somewhat as Gillette Burgess felt about the purple cow. You know the line, I never saw a purple cow, I never hope to see one. About the individuals I know, myself, for example, or those of you who occasionally write me letters, or the people I meet in my classes, about individuals I have the strongest feelings. I think that the world is full of intelligent, curious, active people who much prefer a good book to a poor one, or good music to assembly line jingles. And I believe that the pessimists who have so little faith in the public are probably wrong on another score as well. There's surely never been a time in our history when so many good books, so much fine music, so great a quantity of first-rate creative work of all sorts was freely available to people at little or no expense. The problem is usually one of knowing how to pick the reading or the listening that you enjoy the most. I know that I've spoken to you before of two mentor books which are a very great help in this respect. The first is called Good Reading. This volume contains some 250 pages of annotated lists of fine books on every conceivable subject. If you'd like a list of books about life in ancient Greece or modern America, a checklist of pocketbooks, or if you want to know what books Carl Sandburg or Aldous Huxley couldn't get along without, then Good Reading is the book for you. The other book that I had in mind to mention to you is Alfred Steffrud's The Wonderful World of Books. This volume is loaded with excellent articles on many phases of reading, from the establishment of libraries to the great books program to book collecting. If you're not what used to be called a great reader, you'll probably find many new and useful ideas in the wonderful world of books. And if you are, you know the peculiar fascination of reading about reading. I never leaf through this little volume without finding sentences or paragraphs that oblige me to stop and taste them again. Thus, Louis D. Rubin, in an article on reading short stories, writes a paragraph on how to begin a story that invariably catches my eye.
It's exciting to watch the way a good short story writer arouses his reader's interest almost immediately, making him eager to keep reading just as soon as he has begun the first sentence or paragraph. Here, for example, is the late Sir Arthur Conan Doyle beginning a detective story. It was on a bitterly cold night and frosty morning towards the end of the winter of 97 that I was awakened by a tugging at my shoulder. It was Holmes. The candle in his hand shone on his eager, stooping face and told me at a glance that something was amiss. He cried, "Come, Watson, come. Come. The game is afoot. Not a word. Into your clothes and come." Could you lay aside that story now? Not if you possess any great fondness for adventure. A cold winter morning and Sherlock Holmes awakens you. The game is afoot, and for the time being, you are Conan Doyle's willing partner. In 69 words, he has created the suspense needed to make you eager to read on.
And so he has. In fact, at this point, I was sufficiently sidetracked from Mr. Rubin's article to go back and read, for perhaps the 100th time, The Adventure of the Abbey Grange, the story which Doyle commenced in so superb a style. I should add, incidentally, that later on I finished Mr. Rubin's article, and that it stimulated me to read a number of other short stories, some very familiar and others quite new to me. This, of course, is the purpose of the wonderful world of books. It's not the sort of book to be read for its own sake. It's rather a starting point for an endlessly various and interesting course of reading. Books like Good Reading and The Wonderful World of Books must be regarded, I think, not as ordinary books, but as blueprints for continuing education, as charts to guide you in your explorations of human experience as it's reported in literature. There are a good many other pleasing bits from Mr. Stefford's collection that I think you would enjoy. Holbrook Jackson, for instance, quoting Richard Whitlock, a 17th century book lover.
Books are life's best business. They are feeless counselors, no delaying patrons of easy access and kind expedition, never sending away any client or petitioner. They are for company, the best friends. In doubts, counselors. In dumps, comforters. The home traveler's ship or horse, the busy man's best recreation, the opiate of idle weariness, the mind's best ordinary, nature's garden, and the seed plot of immortality.
All of which is indeed a charming tribute to books, but the passage prompted me to wonder, what would such bibliophiles ever have done if Cicero hadn't written his great oration in defense of Arcius the poet? Poor Arcius, I suppose, might very well have been hanged for his sins, either as poet or civilian, for his defense counsel so delighted in the chance to say a good word for books that he almost left Arcius out of his plea. Some of you undoubtedly had to construe Pro Arcia in high school or college, and if you did, you surely will remember that noble sentence about books which ends per noctant nobiscum peregrinantur rusticantur. I remember the line chiefly because it suggests such delightful images of Cicero propped up in bed, reading through the night by lamplight, or slumped in a convenient corner of his carriage with a scroll unrolled before him, or rusticating, scanning the long and beautiful Greek lines as he sits at ease in a country garden. Well, these are pleasant pictures, and 2,000 years, which have wiped out so much other understanding, do not prevent us from feeling a kindliness for a fellow book lover. All this, of course, is by the way, and still by the way, though I feel that I must mention the matter, is an article of mostly good advice by Lionel McCalvin on choosing and using books. It's the last paragraph of Mr. McCalvin's article with which I take issue. It runs,
"It is often said that books take up a lot of room. As a matter of fact, a bookcase 3 feet 6 inches high by 3 feet 6 inches wide will take 180 books of assorted sizes. And this bookcase need not project more than 7 inches from the wall."
This remark, which is obviously aimed at those housekeepers who fear that books will ultimately crowd them completely out of the house, is quite misleading in my opinion. To be sure, 180 books may not occupy much more than, say, 6 cubic feet, but whoever was content to stop with 180 books... But we must press on and not spend all our time in these bypaths, however pleasant they are. Quite appropriately, The Wonderful World of Books includes a long section of articles on libraries and librarians, which may come as something of a revelation to you. I don't think that most people, even those who make good use of libraries, ever quite realize how important these institutions and the people who run them can be. A librarian, believe me, can be, and usually is, much more than the pleasant person who stamps your card on the way out and sometimes charges you a fine on overdue books on your way in. The principal reason for this program, indeed, is to underline one service which American librarians perform for you, which I think is much too little known. In the course of the past week, the American Library Association has been holding its midwinter meeting here in Chicago. Along with a good many other activities, the librarians presented two reports on books which were published in 1954. Now, I don't know how many books appeared in the United States last year, some thousands, I suppose, and at any rate, many more than any individual could read or even look at. And how do you, who like to read good books, find out or decide which are the best of all these books, the ones you don't want to miss? The ALA, I think, has performed quite a useful public service in preparing two book lists. One of these lists is called Notable Books of 1954, and the other, Interesting Adult Books of 1954 for Young People. Now, these are not necessarily lists of bestsellers. Librarians, you see, have a special professional outlook. When they buy books, they can't afford to be influenced entirely by what is currently popular. They have to spend their funds on books which they think will have some permanent value to their patrons, too. And consequently, I think that the term notable books is quite a good one. I should probably make some special mention of the young people's list. Now, please don't be deceived by the title. The books which are included are not books for teenagers, certainly not juvenile books. The list includes such excellent and thoroughly adult works as Jacqueline Cochran's The Stars at Noon, Heinrich Harrer's 7 Years in Tibet, and Kenneth Dodson's novel of the amphibious war in the Pacific, Away All Boats. These are, as you see, adult books, which should also have a special appeal for younger people. Now, I don't propose to read these lists to you on the air. The American Library Association has been kind enough to let me have a number of copies of both lists, which I shall be very happy to send to you if you will write in to me. What I thought might be interesting instead is to look at some of the books, particularly those on the notable books list, which seem to fit our Americana theme. Some of these we have already mentioned on the air, and others, I'm sorry to say, we've so far missed. At any rate, here is a little anthology of quotations and comments from the notable books of 1954. If you're a confirmed listener to NBC of a Saturday evening, you'll already have met Mr. Jacques Barzan. He's appeared quite frequently of late on Clifton Fadiman's excellent series called Conversation, which I hope you will hear a little later on this evening. Mr. Barzan is a historian by trade, and I think an essayist by preference. He was born in France, but he's lived in the United States for some 30 years, and he's been an American citizen for more than 20. In 1954, he published a book called God's Country and Mine, subtitled A Declaration of Love, Spiced with a Few Harsh Words. God's Country and Mine is one of those books which appear quite regularly, a sort of omnibus assessment of what America is all about. In Mr. Barzan's case, the book works out as an extended essay spiced with sharp observations and a sound knowledge of American history. Let me introduce to you then Mr. Jacques Barzan, discussing ideas, ideologies, and the democratic process.
It is a paradox, but truth nevertheless, that our absence of ideas, the exclusion of ideas from American political life, gives us a superior kind of public morality. In New York, some years ago, a German refugee who was just beginning to breathe freely our sooty but impartial air was attacked and robbed in broad daylight on First Avenue. The young muggers looked to him like the stuff stormtroopers are made of, and he said to himself, "There it goes again." But there was a vast difference. A difference, as he told the court, that on reflection he was able to appreciate. In the first place, the attack had no idea wrapped around it. It was just plain greed. In the second place, the police had no ideology either. They were for the victim, whoever he was. You may say that the impartiality of the law is an idea in itself. The idea of human equality served by the policeman who makes equal the weak and the strong. But that is not the sort of idea which goes to make up ideology. It is far too old and far too simple. Ideology nowadays has to look special and scientific. It is bookish medicine for sick nations. Now, the United States, as part of the human race, is also a great producer of nonsense. Some have said the greatest producer of it, as of nearly everything else. We have thousands of mad cults, as well as the only political party that offers the flatness of the earth for a platform. But we seem to know just what to make of ideas, most of them being hot air. We let them go up out of sight as nature intended. We wait and we see. We are all from two states, our own and Missouri. And yet, for all this skepticism, we are not unresponsive blockheads. We are quick, often too quick, to see danger in our neighbors' views. At the same time, we have the best machinery for agitation. Our press is multitudinous and loud. Our pulpits, lecture platforms, radio, TV stations, they pour out a steady stream of opinion, debate, and argument. Almost everybody who has learned to sign his name can somewhere print what he thinks. So described, democracy sounds anything but noble. It is as vulgar and higgledy-piggledy as trade, but there are things about which a man has no right to act noble. Pretending that the need for agitation doesn't exist means concealing the necessary mess behind a false front. The people are kept gaping at a puppet show of ideologists, but behind these stretch the concentration camps and the torture chambers. It's the part of maturity to take the mess in stride and suspect all quick disinfectants.
But now let's move along our list of notable books. There were some really first-rate biographies published in 1954. One that I particularly enjoyed is Herman Hagedorn's The Roosevelt Family of Sagamore Hill. Of course, this book focuses chiefly on the great Theodore, Rough Rider, President, Man of Letters, and so on and so on. I suppose that Theodore Roosevelt's place in the public esteem is not too clear even now. His character, habits, and ideas were certainly attacked and satirized enough during his lifetime. And in all truth, it seems to me that there was a good deal to satirize. And yet when I read as fine a biography of Roosevelt as Mr. Hagedorn's has turned out to be, I find the Colonel an extremely refreshing and enlivening sort of individual. And I think I know why. Most of us at the midpoint of the century cannot help feeling occasionally that we're the helpless victims of circumstance. Life presses pretty hard on us, and it takes all our energy simply to resist the pressures and to survive. It's a fine thing to meet a human being who seems never to be the victim of circumstance, who controls life chiefly because he has a boundless supply of energy and is afraid of nothing. Roosevelt seemed to have these characteristics to the ultimate degree. In one section of the Roosevelt Family of Sagamore Hill, Hagedorn tells a brief anecdote about Mike Murphy, the Yale athletic trainer, who once paid a visit to Mr. Roosevelt at Oyster Bay.
On the chartered excursion boat, taking the team back to New York, a friend, Gustavus Kirby, came upon Murphy sitting in the cabin in deep thought. Murphy mused, "I suppose you think that I'm the greatest athletic trainer in the world. Well, you're all wrong. Until we went to Oyster Bay, I thought I might be, but now I know I'm not."
"Mike, that's nonsense," exclaimed his friend.
"No. Nope, give me 60 men, every one a champion, and let that man at Oyster Bay have 60 other men. And every one of them dubs, and his team would lick mine every time. You see, it's this way. That man down there would tell a miler that he could reel a mile off in 4 minutes. As you know, no one has run or ever will run a mile in 4 minutes. But not only would that man think he could run a mile in 4 minutes, but by God, he'd go and do it."
Biography's a fine thing. You meet such interesting people that way. Not all of them, of course, as colorful as Theodore Roosevelt, but each of them in his own way fascinating and complex. I've been reading, for example, the autobiography called The Manner is Ordinary, a thoroughly sophisticated book by Father John Lafarge of the Society of Jesus. Among the most interesting sections of this book to me were those which dealt with Father Lafarge's journalistic experiences. He was, as you may know, a columnist and later editor of the magazine America. Perhaps, if you're not familiar with his writing, some of Father Lafarge's editorial attitudes may surprise you a little.
It was somewhat mystifying for an editor to notice how many religious-minded people were earnestly praying for peace, but were, nevertheless, unwilling to face obvious realities in organizing it, or to acknowledge the patent fact of the existence of a natural international community. They were always ready with objections against the United Nations and complaints as to defects in its organization. Yet, when one undertook to propose concrete action to overcome these defects, they refused to go along. People of all faiths were unspeakably shocked in this country by the brutal deportation of vast masses of population in Europe, such as the people of the Baltic nations, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. Soviet conduct was denounced, and rightly so, as an unspeakable crime against humanity without parallel in all history. Yet, when it was proposed by Professor Raphael Lemkin of Yale to define this crime as genocide and stigmatize it as an offense against humanity and the law of nations, this was attacked as a covert attempt to subvert the Constitution of the United States. When it came to domestic problems, another attitude was common. I was reproached once by one of our clerical readers for making any distinctions at all. "When I pick up a magazine like America," he said, "and see it discuss the issues of the day, I want to know whether things are right or wrong. And I'm not interested in anything in between. If a bill is before Congress, I want to know whether that bill is backed by Christ or whether it's backed by the devil. If it's backed by Christ, I'm for it. If it's backed by the devil, I'm against it. But I don't want to be told anything in between." I had to reassure my friend that a great deal of legislation could not be assigned either to Christ or the devil. Though unprincipled politics are from the devil, there is nevertheless a capacious area left to the ordinary ingenuity of men. The interests of Christ are often better safeguarded by things which work and are legitimate than by theories which are perfect but still theories. This is not Machiavellianism, but simple political common sense. As St. Thomas More remarked in his Utopia, we should not desert the ship of state just because we cannot stop the gales from blowing. For we cannot have everything good unless everybody is good, which I don't expect to happen for a number of years.
I assure you that we might go on indefinitely sampling books here and there from the American Library Association's list of notable books for 1954. There are many fine things on the list. Chester Bowles' Ambassador's Report, Pearl Buck's My Several Worlds, and Gerald Carson's delightful, nostalgic account of the old country store. But to bring our anthology to a close, I can't forbear recommending to you once more Elmer Davis's book, But We Were Born Free, which has proved itself a bestseller, and which will, I'm sure, turn out to be a book of permanent value. Here is Mr. Davis on the interesting question, are we worth saving, and if so, why?
Why should we be saved? What have we got that our adversaries have not that makes us worth saving? Our faults, God knows, are numerous and glaring enough. Recognition of those faults is the chief cause of the loss of confidence that has afflicted so many people of the Western world. But we do recognize them. We do not pretend that our failures were decreed by ineluctable historical necessity, nor do we rewrite history according to the precepts of doublethink, prove that they never happened at all? What have we to offer to the contemporary world and to the future is a method, and the freedom of the mind that makes the method possible. Not an infallible method, but the best yet discovered for reaching increasingly close approximations to the truth. It will never offer its conclusions with such assurance as does dialectical materialism, which, by a singular coincidence, seems always to produce the conclusions which are convenient for the men in power. It can only say, we have kept the door open for exploration of all possibilities, consideration of all objections, application of all possible tests, and this is what seems to be true. Maybe something else will seem more probable later on, but this is the best we can do now. Or as the method was summarized long ago, prove all things, hold fast to that which is good. In saying all this, I'm talking not about Western civilization, but about the United States. And without apology, for we are the principal component of Western civilization, at least in the material sense. If we go down, it all goes down. And when we confront a totalitarian dictatorship, whatever goes down stays down. It doesn't get up again. And we shall go down unless we recognize what we have to fight for and have the courage to fight for it. What makes Western civilization worth saving is the freedom of the mind, now under heavy attack from the primitives, including some university graduates who have persisted among us. If we have not the courage to defend that faith, it won't matter much whether we're saved or not. I should perhaps have begun this sermon with a text. A text taken from the fourth chapter of the first book of Samuel, the 8th and 9th verses, the mutual exhortations of the Philistines before the battle of Ebenezer. Woe unto us, they said, when they realized that the Israelites had brought the ark of God with them into the battle. Woe unto us! Who shall deliver us out of the hands of these mighty gods? But then, realizing that nobody was going to deliver them, they said to one another, be strong. Be strong and quit yourselves like men and fight. And they did fight. They fought and they delivered themselves. So may we. But only if we quit ourselves like men. This republic was not established by cowards. And cowards will not preserve it.
You have been listening to Americana, the 17th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with Station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Malone. Direction is by Ralph Noh. Music supervision by Maury Streetmatter. Audio engineering by Ed Gott. The quoted materials were read by myself, Bill Grissom. The books discussed on tonight's program were Elmer Davis's But We Were Born Free, published by Bobbs Merrill, John Lafarge's The Manner is Ordinary, published by Harcourt Brace, Herman Hattikorn's The Roosevelt Family of Sagamore Hill, published by the Macmillan Company, Jack Barson's God's Country and Mine, published by Little Brown, and Good Reading and the Wonderful World of Books, both published by the New American Library. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, or of the new book lists issued by the American Library Association, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of School of Speech, Northwestern University, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is NBC Radio.